sorrow is done. Although when
are there rational grounds for questioning the standard scientific consensus on climate change springing from human burning of fossil fuels? How and who could be altering the scientific method underlying climate change theories and perhaps other phenomena? How are the Rockefellers, who once dominated the oil industry, laying the groundwork for the climate change movement of today, and why? What is the endgame for the Rockefellers and other financial elites instigating climate action at the expense of the rest of the world? This week on the Global Research News Hour, following the many climate-related events as part of the recent Earth Day celebrations, we have decided to take a close look at the generations-long warnings and alarmism connected to climate change and explore the prospect that the UN and the elites who have orchestrated a lot of this activity may have other devious motives not connected to saving the planet, except, of course, for themselves. In our first half hour, we have a chat with Tom Nelson, a climate skeptic and producer of the recent film Climate the Movie, The Cold Truth. Then in our second half hour, we speak with Jacob Nordengard about his recent book Rockefeller Controlling the Game, exploring how one of the most influential figures on the planet was able to both scientifically and politically anchor the climate movement. On this week's program, how dare you? Alternative perspectives on non-existent, human-generated climate change. Bringing you the analysis beyond the media headlines, the Global Research News Hour is on the air. Welcome to the Global Research News Hour for the week of April 26th, 2024. The program is funded by the Center for Research on Globalization and produced in collaboration with campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg. I'm your host, Michael Welch. The show seeks to provide listeners with access to analysis of some of the major issues shaping our world today from thinkers, researchers, and unique political personalities rarely addressed by major media. Our shows are featured on partner radio stations across Canada and the United States and available for streaming or download at the site Global Research. We acknowledge that this was produced on the traditional territory of the Anishinaabe, Innu, Oji-Cree, Dene, and Dakota, the birthplace of the Métis Nation and the heart of the Métis Nation homeland. The European people who settled this soil 500 years ago attained enormous assets and wealth from the land, but at the expense of the indigenous people who were here first and shared what they had through theft, fraudulent promises and faulty treaties on the settler side. The settlers should rectify the wealth they inherited with the people they took it from through land back and other reparations and share a more respectful partnership with other people on this land. Never again should we be indifferent to the colonialism and genocides imposed on others. Now it's time for News Notes, a sampling of articles from the Global Research News site. Listeners should know that some of the articles may run against common messaging about sensitive subjects and are not all endorsed by this radio station. In the words of Philip Giraldi, quote, "As a former intelligence officer, I find it impossible to believe that Israel did not have multiple informants inside Gaza, as well as electronic listening devices all along the border wall, which would have picked up movements of groups and vehicles. In other words, the whole thing might be a tissue of lies, as is often the case," unquote. A tissue of lies has served to justify the killing in the Gaza Strip of more than 34,000 civilians, of which 70% are women and children, coupled with total destruction and an endless string of atrocities. The cat is out of the bag. That's from the intro to the article under the headline, "Is the Gaza-Israel fighting, quote, a false flag, unquote? They let it happen. Their objective is, quote, to wipe Gaza off the map, unquote," by Philip Giraldi and Professor Michel Chosadovsky, posted April 25th. A senior Health Canada official says pharma giant Pfizer made a conscious decision not to advise regulators that its mRNA COVID-19 vaccine contained a DNA sequence from the simian virus 40, or SV40. This information appears among multiple emails between staff from key drug regulators, including Health Canada, or HC, the U.S. Food and Drug Administration, or FDA, and the European Medicines Agency, or EMA. The information was obtained through an access to information request. On August 23, 2023, Dr. Dean Smith, a senior scientific evaluator in Health Canada's Vaccine Quality Division, wrote an email to a colleague at the FDA about SV40. Health Canada had obtained confirmation 2 weeks earlier from Pfizer that SV40 DNA sequences were present in its COVID-19 vaccine. That comes from the article, Pfizer, quote, chose not to, unquote, tell regulators about SV40 sequence in COVID shots, Health Canada official, by Noé Chartier and Matthew Horwood, posted April 25th, originally published on the Epoch Times. Here it is important to understand that the spike protein gets into the body with the infection and to a much greater degree is produced by mRNA within the body in the vaccinated. Sadly, most vaccinated persons has both forms of spike protein. As of today, antibodies to the spike protein can be measured as a proxy for how much is in the body. Soon, the spike protein itself should be measurable on a blood test. Because our bodies cannot readily clear spike, we use McCullough protocol-based spike detoxification to aid the body in catabolism and clearance of this foreign invader. That comes from the article, Health Benefits of Caffeine, Retained Spike Protein Causing Long COVID Pandemic Preparedness for Avian Influenza, by Dr. Peter McCullough, posted April 25th, originally published on Courageous Discourse. They are not saying no to the allocation of their money for killing to eventually live in peace. Killing and atrocities are intermediary stages for peace. The U.S. Congress has just allocated another $95 billion to Ukraine and Israel to continue killing themselves and each other into the final stages of peace. Still, people in the name of peace do not say no as in no. Do not give our money for slaughtering more people. They may hope peace will come and engulf them all. Otherwise, it is not fathomable that they let their money being transferred into guns and tanks and bombs so they may kill, working towards peace. That comes from the article, Massive Propaganda Has Brainwashed You to Believe That Wars Make Peace, by Peter Koenig, posted April 25th. These are just a few of the featured articles appearing last week on the Global Research website. Regular visitors to the site are encouraged to send monetary contributions by fax, mail, or online. Just go to globalresearch.ca and click Donate on the menu bar. My own devotion to the traditional climate narrative goes back nearly 40 years. All the great popularizers of climate science, most notably David Suzuki and Carl Sagan, and prominent environmentalists like Elizabeth May, and elements of nearly every organization on the left were promoting the idea that too much carbon dioxide in the atmosphere springing from cars and fossil fuel burning factories are contributing extra elements of greenhouse gas emissions, which is essentially leading to the slow heating up of our atmosphere. And lessons from international gatherings like the Conference of the Parties of the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change were continually sending out warnings based on the peer-reviewed journal literature that we had to act quickly to reverse this trend toward climate catastrophe leading to a degraded, perhaps even an unsurvivable planet. I took these warnings seriously throughout most of my life, even being lulled into the conclusion that people speaking out against this theory of global warming were compelled to do so by money from the big oil companies. And I even went so far as to give up my driver's license as part of my efforts to contribute less to weather weirdness, okay? Now, however, following the COVID crisis and the way the science of the dissenting experts was instantly tagged as disinformation, I'm a little more open now to the claims of some of the experts populating the so-called climate skeptics camp. And some of the information they are putting forward is hard to reconcile with what the official narrative of the last four decades of studies has put out. I found recently these observations summed up in an 80-minute film called Climate the Movie, The Cold Truth. I got hold of Tom Nelson, the producer of the film, who also does a regular podcast. And Tom Nelson has a master's degree in electronics and electrical engineering. He was involved in tech and software for many years. And he says that as an avid bird watcher, he successfully debunked a lot of the high-profile but bogus ivory-billed woodpecker rediscovery that opened his eyes about the problems of blindly trusting peer-reviewed science, and soon afterward spotted parallels with a lot of what was being said about climate change. So Tom, he was on his podcast, and he spoke a lot to list a lot of dissident experts on the subject, including Richard Lindzen, Will Happer, Mark Morano, Judith Curry, Carl Otto Weiss, Valentina Zarkova, Christopher Essex, Henrik Svensmark, Patrick Moore, Ross McKittrick, Willie Soon, Susan Crawford, Peter Ridd, and Christopher Monckton. Tom Nelson will join to talk about his film and do quite a great deal to shake my faith in the so-called climate consensus. Tom Nelson, thank you for joining us on the Global Research News Hour.
Yeah, thanks for having me on. I appreciate it.
Now, I imagine that you yourself, like me, trusted climate change science at some point. Would you like to focus, first of all, about how you researched climate change and started to notice errors and inconsistencies with what was published and what was real? I mean, like, what was your the first deviation that you noticed that you can recall?
Yeah, so maybe like you, as of 2005, I believed that experts had proved it and the Earth was warming up kind of dangerously. That's as far as I took it. I never dug into it. But around that time, there was this ivory-billed woodpecker thing that you mentioned. And it was a big deal in the birdwatching world that this extinct bird had been rediscovered. And there was a paper with 17 authors on it. It was supposed to be scientific truth. But I dug into that one as a birdwatcher, and I found out the whole thing was a crock. They were supposed to have a picture of it, but it was a 6-pixel picture, 2 whites, 2 blacks, 2 whites. And it was amazing that this peer-reviewed science was not true. But around that time, somebody emailed me, actually, and they said, now you should look at the climate debate, because it's a very similar thing, that if you dig into it for yourself, you're going to find out that the evidence doesn't match the hype at all. So I just checked into it, and that very first day as I started looking into the claims, I found out that I was shocked to find that the claims didn't match the evidence at all. So that was back around 2006, actually, then. And since then, I've kind of been looking at the climate debate for hours, most days, just looking at all the claims and digging down into all the rabbit holes, and I'm finding out that every single alarming thing that you've heard about CO2 causing bad weather or poor crop yields, etc., every single alarming thing is wrong.
And how did you, because there were a number of experts who appeared on the film within the first few minutes. I mean, how did you connect with them?
Yeah, it's been great for me just as a podcaster. For many years, I was just reading everybody's work and generally not contacting them. But in July of 22, I started this podcast, and I've done over 200 episodes. And since then, I've been in email contact and phone contact, et cetera, with lots of high-profile climate scientists and other people. And it's been a great learning experience as I sit, and typically for an hour, I can listen to their side of the story and find out, dig into wildfires and hurricanes and geologic heat and just all sorts of things. It's a very interesting debate because there's so many facets to it. And yeah, I've learned so much, I feel like, just in the last couple of years. But even before that, you don't need to dig into it like I have in order to be suspicious, because you can just look at any one part of the debate on its own. You can just look at polar bear data, for example, or just at wildfire data, or just at even high temperature data. there's so many people who are blogging about it that so many people who are writing about it that you can dig into one area on your own quite easily, and you don't have to be a climate scientist. That's kind of the propaganda that you are, as an ordinary person, you can't dig into this. You have to trust the experts. My message is you don't have to trust the experts. If you just do sanity checking as an ordinary person, if you can read graphs and look at data, you can find out this whole thing is a crock.
Talk about your film. It was very well put together. You got hold of Martin Durkin to write and narrate the film. I mean, how did you connect with him, or did he connect with you?
We kind of connected as a happy accident. I was a huge fan of his 2007 film, The Great Global Warming Swindle. I think it still stands up even to this day. He did a great job with that. And so as a fan, and as I was doing this podcast, I invited him to be on my podcast. And just as an aside, partway through that podcast, Martin said, you know, I'd really like to remake that movie. If I had a chance, knowing what I know now, I think I could lay out the case in a more clear manner, et cetera. So that kicked off this whole thing. Given that start, we started working together, and in a few months after that, started making the movie. And I give him all the credit in the world because, like you say, he did this movie. He actually did the interviews, and he wrote the script for the movie and did the narration. And he is just a great movie maker, documentary filmmaker. He's got a huge amount of experience in making these. He's been involved in probably over 100 documentaries in his long career. And he was exactly the right person to make this movie at exactly the right time. I'm very happy with how it all came out.
And this movie's been out on YouTube about a month now. How many people have actually come and visited the site since?
Yeah, it's hard to find out exactly, but it's in the millions because it's not just on YouTube. It's all over the place. There's lots of full copies are up on X or Twitter. Some guy tweeted it out. The Wide Awake Media guy tweeted out a copy of the movie, and that tweet itself has 1.3 million views already. There's lots of individual tweets and posts that have over 100,000 up to 300,000 views. And it's also on Rumble and BitChute. It's on Substack. It's kind of everywhere. So we made this movie available for free so anybody can go to my Substack. And there's a link there. You can download a full copy of the movie yourself and download clips from the movie. And then you can just put them up anywhere you want. So you can put them up on your own social media feeds. And lots of people have done that. There are over 100 full copies of the movie out there. And the Clintel people over in Europe, they have taken on the job of translating the movie into lots of languages. They're pushing 30 languages. They're over 25, and they're going towards 30 languages. They're just doing a great job. It's starting to take off in Asia. They're doing some premieres in South Korea, and I'm starting to get some feedback now that the South Koreans are digging into this as well. And I'm very happy. In 1 month, it's just spreading like kind of like a virus, and it's a good virus in this case.
You divided the film into chapters, and the first one devoted to the science of climate change. For example, among other points you list as facts, you state that there were times when the Earth had more carbon dioxide than we have had in the last 550 million years. And not only did it exceed 350 parts per million, which scientists and activists want us to curb today, but being as high as 7,000 parts per million, and at a time when Earth was swarming with life. You know, talk a bit more, if you can, about all the inconvenient science from the standpoint of the consensus believers and how you have heard the consensus experts account for what they, you know, the disparity with what they preach.
Yeah, it's just full of disparities, and they don't really account for those. Like this whole look at the last 600 million years of the Earth's history, for by far most of that time, there's been way more CO2 in the air than there is now. So we're definitely towards the lower end of the CO2 levels. We're about at a little over 420 parts per million right now, as you said, and that's pretty close to the low end. And if we get down to maybe 180 or so, it gets really hard for plants to grow because CO2 is not the climate control knob, but it absolutely is. It's critical for photosynthesis. And if we don't have enough, then plants at high altitude, for example, start to die off. So the whole idea that there's too much CO2, that's a total non-starter if you look at even the last 600 million years. Then the warmth of the Earth in the last 600 million years, again, we are closer, way closer to the coldest it's been than the warmest it's been. It's been way warmer than this most of that time, naturally. So as Patrick Moore says, right now we are in an ice age because we have ice at the poles. For most of that time, there wasn't any ice at the poles. So the whole idea that Earth is dangerously hot right now, or that there's too much CO2 clogging the air or something, none of that makes any sense. And I don't really hear people on the other side, they don't really refute that. It's just terribly inconvenient to the whole narrative. And there's trillions of dollars, enormous amounts of power and money on the line here. So they don't like to hear anybody talking about this.
In the distant past, sure, it was warmer and more carbon dioxide, but the Earth was only seeing changes over the course of maybe 1 degree per millennium, whereas in the 20th and 21st century, it seems to be going up by 1 degree over a few decades, you know? And then that rate of change, maybe it's just too rapid for the ecosystem to deal with. I mean, do you think that can rectify, you know, some of your science to some extent?
No, that is the narrative, but I completely don't agree with that at either because nobody knows how fast the Earth's temperature was changing decade per decade. I keep asking them, how fast did the climate change even 1,000 years ago? Let's say year to year, 1,000 years ago, how fast did the climate change? Or we just don't have the resolution for a million years ago. There's this idea that it was changing very slowly then, but we don't have any resolution to find out how fast it was changing. It's been naturally changing forever. There's no reason to believe that it wasn't changing just this fast all the time, maybe millions of other times in the past. I would lay money that millions of other times the climate has changed at the rate of the 20th century naturally. There's no evidence to support that it's faster than or some sort of unusual thing. And even in since humans have been around, the best long-running temperature record we have is the Central England temperature record. That one's been around for hundreds of years. And there was a time back, I don't have it in front of me, around us late 1600s, where the rate of change was something like four times as fast as we've seen now. So for whatever reason, back then, it warmed quite quickly. And nobody knows what really caused all this warming and cooling. People are guessing. They have lots of different guesses, and they pretend they know. But the big picture is that natural variability is a thing. It's a major thing. And the Earth's temperature changes on many different timescales. It can change on very long timescales, and it can definitely change quite quickly just in one decade. And we're not sure why.
You mentioned later on in the movie about climate change alarmism really taking off under Senator Al Gore. I mean, he was a really key player in all of this. How did his advocacy relating to scientists from inside and outside climate science jumping on how did his advocacy relate to all of the scientists inside and outside of climate science, you know, jumping on the carbon climate change bandwagon?
Yeah, he had power in the when he was vice president. I don't have the details in front of me, but there have been lots of scientists in general who have kind of been canceled for speaking out against the narrative. So even back then, I have to remember, I think David Legates, who was just on my podcast this morning, I think he may have had a run-in with the administration, maybe even with Gore himself. But definitely there have been there have been costs to pay, or maybe your job to pay, if you spoke out against the narrative. So the science has been shaped by the politics for decades, for sure. Climate science has been heavily shaped by politics. The IPCC has been, it's an intergovernmental panel. It's not a scientific panel. So there's no reason to think that science has just been sitting on its own, unaffected by politics. It's been very, very heavily affected by politics. And people see this whole thing, the climate scare, as a great way to win political power and to control our lives. It's a huge, huge factor.
I was once, at one time, a scholar in science, albeit it was at the undergraduate level. But I learned that progress in science starts with the humble position, I don't know, then making a guess, and then testing the guess with a battery of experiments. And if it stands up, then you start to get a theory of what's going on. That's the glory of science, the first and only knowledge process where you proceed by trying to disprove what you think you know. If you're right about the false science of climate change, where exactly is the science process being disrupted?
Well, I mean, we can't actually change the CO2 levels on Earth and just in the lab. We can't change it and see what happens. But we can already see that like between the 40s and the 70s, we increased the amount of CO2 on Earth. We emitted a lot of CO2. And the hypothesis is if you increase the CO2, the temperature goes up. But for three decades, we increased it, and the temperature did exactly the opposite. It went down. So there are many examples of not lab experiments with CO2, but in real life, we've seen increasing CO2 doesn't increase the temperature and vice versa. So that's one big thing. You're asking exactly where this thing went off the rails? It's extremely interesting. I think a big part of what's happened in recent decades is just straight-up groupthink. I deal with quite a few climate scientists, at least briefly, on Twitter and elsewhere, and I can see that they don't know almost any of this data that I'm talking about polar bear numbers are going up or whatever else. They've just they've gone into climate science thinking that they were right. Experts have already proven this, and anybody who disagrees must be paid off by big oil or whatever else. That their knowledge of actually natural variability is very small. So just I think simple groupthink is one of the biggest factors here that's causing scientists to push this thing when the data does not back it up. It's pretty amazing. Scientists are not immune to just basic human flaws that the rest of us have.
Okay, well, how did this science process come to affect environmentalists and activists to the extent that they're now, spray painting arts in museums and disrupting traffic in some places, demanding we pay attention? I mean, normally these folks don't generally pay that much attention to science with regard to other environmental problems, right? So, or I don't know, maybe they do. what is your sense?
I do think that actual mental illness is a problem here. I think this some of these people are literally mentally ill. There's been a couple people who have doused themselves with fuel and killed themselves over this. There are people who believe every day that human civilization is going to end because of CO2. There's a certain percentage of people that can be sucked in by this narrative. So I think a good percentage of them that are gluing themselves to stuff, they actually believe that they're saving the planet. And I think, I don't know, can't get into their heads, but psychologically, I think it appeals to some people that their life has so much meaning if every day they're saving human civilization. And I think they're disappointed. They don't want to hear anything about CO2 being actually beneficial. And all the stuff they've done their entire life in this area has been on the wrong side of the science. Nobody wants to hear that they've wasted their life. So, yeah, I think a lot of people sincerely believe this. I think some of the protesters actually may be paid. There's a climate defiance group that admits that they're taking in money from the Hollywood types and stuff. So I think some of the people that are walking around carrying signs that are professionally made, some of them, I think, are paid to do that as well. But, again, groupthink is a huge factor.
What's the point of all this, though, Thomas? I mean, is it just excitedness about the effect on the future, or do you think certain players are trying to get some money out of this climate change dynamic?
Yeah, certain people at the top are definitely trying to get money and power. And you can straight up see some of it, that even Elon Musk, I'm kind of a fan in what he's done with opening up X. But he has great incentive to not speak out too much against this, just because a major reason to subsidize Tesla and to get people to buy Tesla cars is because they're saving the planet. And if you buy your Tesla car, you're a good person who is helping to save human civilization. So there's a lot of allegedly green products that sales are going to absolutely plummet if people realize that CO2 is a good thing. That includes electric cars and people who are selling solar panels and wind power and maybe even ethanol. And there's all sorts of products that people buy with the idea that they're saving the planet. They're willing to maybe pay a premium. So money is definitely a part. And then I think the Bill Gates types of the world, Klaus Schwab, et cetera, other politicians. As Richard Lindzen says, if you can control carbon or carbon dioxide, you can control life. So if they can actually sell this to us, then they might have the ability to control how much we fly and what food we eat and where we live and maybe confine us to 15-minute cities and maybe get rid of private transportation entirely. There's all sorts of things that they could do. And I think some people, like Bill Gates, I think he actually would like to control us and have big power over the way we live our lives, because the little people, there's too many of us and there's just the right amount of him.
Interesting discussion. Tom Nelson, thank you very much for agreeing to speak with me, and congratulations on your very successful movie.
All right. Thank you very much for having me on. I appreciate it, Michael.
We've been speaking to Tom Nelson, a climate change skeptic, a podcast producer, as well as the producer of Climate Change the Movie, The Cold Truth. You can find it now for free by running the search on YouTube.
You're listening to the Global Research News Hour, broadcasting from CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg and from partnering radio stations across Canada and the United States.
Jacob Nordengard is a Swedish researcher, author, lecturer, and musician. He holds a PhD in technology and social change at Linköping University, Master of Science, Social Science in Geography, and a Master of Social Science in Culture and Media Production. Jacob Nordengard joins us from Sweden to discuss his latest work, Rockefeller, Controlling the Game. Welcome to the Global Research News Hour.
Yeah, thank you very much for having me on.
Why would you place yourself at odds with what appears to be the vast majority of scientists? I mean, were you always this hard-nosed about it, or did you have a change of heart?
I had a change of heart, and that's because, I mean, before I believed in it because media told me it was this way, and at the university, they told us this is the way, so I had no doubts about it until one day I actually was, I was preparing and writing a student paper as a student in geography, and I was doing a study about biofuels, and because of this biofuels boom, and I wanted to know why it was such a big interest in, and one of the reasons was climate. Biofuels would solve climate change. So I had to check the science, because I wanted to know, okay, how will this the climate change affect biofuels production, etc. So I started to make an investigation in this. It was like in 2006, I think. And as I was doing this, I got kind of shocked, because I didn't find any decent science that validated this theory about human involvement in changing the climate. I just found climate models, and no hard science that could back up all these, I mean, hysteria that I was used to. So it took, like, I think a couple of days as I was investigating the field, and I actually contacted a couple of Swedish professors and researchers in climate science that were kind of skeptical to this, and it was again shocking to hear their stories about this.
All, like, the multitudes of public literature, and you say it's not really rooted in, it's based in models rather than actual scientific evidence that human beings are influencing things.
Yeah, I mean, it wasn't, it isn't possible to prove. I mean, I think the most of climate scientists think that humans can have some influence, but it's very hard to say how much. And also this, it was surprising also to find out about how much carbon dioxide it's actually in the atmosphere. And how much of that carbon dioxide that was from human sources. And when you looked into that, it was just, what is this? I mean, it was just so stupid. And it was like nobody at the university seemed to have, I mean, they trusted science, but they hadn't checked it. There was no one. It was like, well, the IPCC states this. I don't have to do my own work on this. I don't have to check the science behind it, and so on.
I know, I'm thinking of Big Pharma having a way of leaning the weight of medical journalistic records in their direction. I mean, the big pharmaceutical corporations have enormous money and enormous clout as a lobbying power. If a researcher wants to test a study for how a disease can be treated without prescription medication, he's not going to get funded. You know, it's the same principle behind the overwhelming dominance of research articulating climate change, isn't it? Or is if so, what is
yes.
the substitute for Big Pharma in this equation?
We're talking about climate now.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, the thing is, I found that we had a big, it was so much money. That was the next part of it. When I found out this, I wanted to know, how is this funded? Who are which are the big sources? And I had heard that, Big Oil was involved with skeptical scientists and trying to give false perceptions about how climate works and so on. And when I made that investigation, it was just, what? Okay. Because I wanted to do a more historical review as well and go back and see where it all started. And I found all these big foundations that were built up with money and capital from the oil industry, as well as the automobile industry or air industry. So it was very strange. And one of those were the Rockefeller Foundation.
I remember.
So I
remember hearing about the climate change, the carbon-based climate change through the popularizers of science way back in the 1980s, you know, Carl Sagan and David Suzuki in North America. And you went back decades to determine how carbon-based climate change made its entry into public dialogue. And actually, it started way back in the 19th century with Svante Arrhenius, who developed the theory, as I understand it. And the Rockefellers had a role in resurrecting this theory. Why did it suit their money-making goals, especially at a time when burning oil and coal was not at all unpopular like it has become today?
Yes. I mean, these are very, very strategic people. And it's the difference between being a philanthrope. You can work on a larger time scale compared to if you're into business only or if you're a politician. So it's stated in one report that I read as a PhD student. It's called Designing to Win, and it was a lot of American foundations that had commissioned this, and they said that we philanthropists can work for a century with our goals, but one who is into business just looks into every quarter, and the politicians just want to be reelected. We don't have that problem. So the Rockefellers, they had ambitions, and one of these were internationalism, because they wanted to have they saw they have never been nationalistic. They have always been into globalization and global business and so on. And they were very influential in the setup of the United Nations in 1945. And during the 50s, they had Nelson Rockefeller, who later became the vice president. He was became the president, the chairman of the Rockefeller Brothers Fund. And the first thing he did was to put up a commission that worked with... it was a more as a brain trust with very, very smart people, including his brothers. They investigated, you can say, the future and the future development. And they wanted to, they say this in the report that came out called the Special Studies Project, that they wanted to, it was their historical mission to create a sort of new world order in all its dimensions. And in this report, they say that we have United Nations now, and we kind of want to make it more powerful. We have to use kind of... methods to do this, to make United Nations more powerful. So we are in need of global problems that this very new organization can work with. And so they said that science is something that is international. We have international cooperation, and it's we even have cooperation between East and West and so on. So science is perfect. And then they discussed some scientific problems that could be useful, and that was global health was one of them. We were heavily involved with WHO at this time. And the other thing was oceanography and meteorology, climate. Because these were, and they said, climate, I mean, it's global. It knows no borders. So if there will be problems with the climate, if humans can influence the climate, it might create these problems that will make it, there will be a need for global governance. There will be need for new international institutions to take care of this. So that was their motif at that time. That was what they stated. And then they started to influence the science, because they had a huge influence in science at that time, with Rockefeller Foundation, of course. Rockefeller Foundation, I mean, it was one of the largest private foundations that gave money to scientific institutions. And we also hired some very, very influential people. One of them was Detlev Bronck, and he was the head of the National Academy of Sciences, and also at the president of Rockefeller University, and had been president at the Johns Hopkins University. And he had, he was hugely influential. And with that power, they could more or less set up new scientific study groups that were involved with climate change, and climate change that was about human influence of the climate.
If you just joined us, you're listening to the Global Research News Hour. My name is Michael Welch, and I'm interviewing Jacob Nordengard, who is the author of Rockefeller Controlling the Game. Mr. Nordengard, I wonder if you could talk about the timeline here. I mean, say key principal events launching us on the path that led us towards the Paris Agreement of 2015, the International Treaty on Climate Change, and also about the Rockefeller involvement throughout.
Yes, I mean, the first one was in the 50s. It was the International Geophysical Year. That was one of the recommendations in their special studies project report, that that is a good starting point to influence that. And that started a lot of the scientific work with climate science and carbon dioxide theory. And then we had a meeting in the 60s at a conference, the first international conference on carbon dioxide in 1963. It was Conservation Foundation, an organization that was founded by Rockefellers. So we had the first meeting with like five scientists from Sweden and from USA started with them. And then they influenced Lyndon Johnson to start to talk about human influence of the climate. In 1965, he had a speech about this. And then in 1972, before it was a big international environmental meeting in Stockholm, the Stockholm Conference, very, very important for the environmental agenda. And that was very crucial for take these ideas of human influence on the climate to, so that was the place where, and the Rockefellers were very, very involved in the setup of this conference and everything. We had this, their henchman, Maurice Strong, was leading the meeting and so on. And they had also prepared a couple of reports that were pointing at the influence in the climate. So that started a process that led up to the 80s, because at that time, the United Nations said, now we have to do a study about this. So in the 80s, they had a couple of meetings in Villach in Austria. That was also with money from the Rockefeller Brothers Fund and Rockefeller Foundation, and that set the foundation for what was to become the IPCC, International Panel on Climate Change. And then they started to work on the next part, and that was the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change. And that was decided at the Rio Conference in 1992. Also with Maurice Strong, their man at the front, and then it continued from that, because that started all these climate meetings that when led up to first, I mean, we had a Kyoto Protocol. And if you read the Rockefeller material, they say, we send Al Gore to Kyoto and we, we funded operations for this. And then they had the Copenhagen meeting in 2009. And that wasn't working as it should. They wanted this big deal at that time. But China wasn't on board. Totally. So the Rockefeller Brothers Fund actually, they had some good contacts in China. So they led the negotiations with China. So eventually China went on board as well. And in 2015, we had the Paris Agreement with the Rockefeller Brothers Fund were sitting at the press conference together with 350.org, this environmental organizations, funded by the Rockefellers, by the way, and said that they were very, very satisfied with the achievement they had done.
Wow. So basically, I think this, the Rockefellers were persuaded by more than Greta Thunberg, you know, making passionate pleas and guilting their conscience. But could you just spend a couple of minutes, just talk about Greta Thunberg, because I mean, she's a Swede as well. And yeah. I think the rest of the world sees her as a dynamic, thoughtful youth who loves her planet so much. And she accidentally became a superstar. Could you share a few details about Get Greta that most in the world would not know about that is relevant to this discussion?
Well, Greta is, she's more or less created for this mission. And actually, they had meetings at the conference, United Nations conference in Germany, years before Greta Thunberg became the young activist. And they, at that meeting, they discussed the idea of having school strikes. And they started this a kind of project with this, with, I mean, United Nations. And we had people from the Club of Rome and so on, very, very powerful individuals. And then they they wanted to find a perfect girl for this project. So a couple of years later, Greta was kind of approached to do this. And of course, I would say she is herself convinced that she's doing the right thing, but it was a lot of people around her that kind of, I mean, one of the things with Greta, it's that the first day she was had this school strike sitting outside the Swedish parliament, a movie team happened to pass by, just happened, and decided to start to do a documentary about her. And the same day, her mother, that is Malena Ernman, she's a famous opera singer in Sweden, and her new book came out the same week. So it was and it created this media thing. And her mother had been involved in this a couple of years before, very much into the cultural establishment in Sweden. So she wasn't just an ordinary schoolgirl from Sweden. She was, and also actually related to Svante Arrhenius as well.
Wow. Well, we got to begin to sum up soon, but could you just say what exactly is the goal of all this climate action that advantages the Rockefellers and other financial elites at the expense of the rest of the world? What's their end goal?
Yeah, yes, I mean, they have envisioned a new world system. A new, because that was one of the important things for them in the beginning, a new global governance regime. That's one part of it. And then also a new technological revolution. That's the fourth industrial revolution. So with the climate, I mean, if you look into policy about climate and European Union, for example, they talk a lot about Green Deal and green tech and everything, and that's all about digitization. It's about computerization. It's about measuring everything. It's about controlling the carbon, and controlling the carbon is controlling people and processes and everything. So their end goal is to create this system that I call a sort of a world brain. That's the ideal, and this is taken from H.G. Wells. He had this idea that has been a huge influence on the futurist movement. So it's a kind of an idea to try to control and steer the world. The idea in this futuristic ideology is to be able to create the future you want. You will not just accepting what's coming. You actually create what is coming. Mm-hmm. So that was the planning. So that's what the whole system is about. And carbon is a backbone of this, because it's the control of, if you control carbon, you control life. So this is the control of life.
Okay, we've got about 2 minutes left. Can you just tell us how we can fight back against the Rockefellers, how we can fight back against the climate agenda then, and other aspects of the game the Rockefeller figure feel that they have controlled?
I think the best thing is to just spread knowledge about this. I mean, very few people know about how much carbon is there in the atmosphere, for example. How much influence have people on this, and also explain this agenda, and how are you going to solve this climate problem? It's all about these big tech solutions that won't. I mean, it won't get create a better world for us. And it's not about saving the planet or saving the environment. It will just make things worse. So I think for myself, it has been important to just get my findings to reach more and more people. And I think and also present the truth, present the facts all the time, because that's one thing that they don't do. They try to control or define what's true. That's how they have done this all the time. So with funding scientists that say the things that they think is the right thing to say, and that is good for the agenda, and discredit everyone that's trying to actually come up with true knowledge. But the thing is, truth always win in the end. You can't beat the truth. It's like a natural force in itself. So, and the thing is, they are also in a hurry to get this machinery up and running. And when they are trying to do that, they have to push very hard, and that creates a backlash for them. And that's where I think we will succeed. I think so many people are starting to understand this, that it will be impossible in the end to make this work.
Jacob Nordengard is a Swedish researcher, author, lecturer, and musician. He's the author of Rockefeller: Controlling the Game, published by Skyhorse Publishing.
That's it for our show this week. Next week, we will return to the latest developments in the Ukraine-NATO war with Russia. You're listening to the Global Research NewsHour, a program funded by the Center for Research on Globalization and produced in collaboration with campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg, on the traditional lands of the Anishinaabe, Innu, Oji-Cree, Dene, and Dakota, the birthplace of the Métis Nation and the heart of the Métis Nation homeland. The show airs on partner radio stations across Canada and the United States and is available for streaming or download at the site globalresearch.ca. To leave feedback on this program, please email globalresearchnewshour@gmail.com. I've been your host, Michael Welch. Thanks once again for joining us.
picnics and coffee, so I opened up my safe.